Hello, everyone. I know that this episode is coming to you in the most surreal and uncertain time, but I hope that this conversation in particular, an incredible story of love, determination and overcoming adversity, will give you that slice of respite during an unprecedented moment for all of us. This week's guest is Jay Blades, and so many of you will know him as the presenter of BBC One's The Repair Shop. I'm a big fan of the show and was excited to meet him and hear his story firsthand. As I sat a few weeks ago waiting for Jay to arrive, I had no idea how apt this conversation would be for the current times, because Jay's is a story of survival, hitting rock bottom, and yet through sharing his vulnerability and allowing others to lift him up, found his way back to the light. I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to Conversations of Inspiration. I'm the founder of Not on the High Street and Holly & Co, and I'm the UK ambassador of creative small businesses. I believe that having a business, doing what you love, is the key to a happy, fulfilled life. And my dream is to help everybody start theirs. So I've reached out to all my favourite small businesses, acclaimed entrepreneurs, and those who just simply inspire me, and asked them to share theirs. With thanks to our sponsor, NatWest, who have helped bring this free podcast to life. Here are my conversations of inspiration.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, Jay. So many of my community have written in and asked me to interview you. We champion makers here at Holly & Co, and we encourage everyone to build a business doing what they love. And most of the time, this is artisans, craftspeople, makers. So you are now speaking to your tribe today.
Wow. Well, first things first, thank you for having me and allowing me to speak to your tribe, I would say. But I want you to say something first is... I've admired what you've done with Not on the High Street, and I know a number of people that sell on your site. And I think what you've done, and I don't actually have my hat on, but I have to put it on for this. I have to take my hat off to you because what you have done to people who are doing their business in their kitchen table, have an idea, have a dream, and don't know how to actually get their product out there, you've given them that avenue. And you are... a real shining star to people. And I don't think you get enough credit for what you have actually started. So I just wanted to say thank you.
I was not expecting that. What a lovely way of starting this. Thank you. That's very kind of you.
No, you've done a lot of good stuff.
Well,
so thank you.
Well, now it's all about you, though.
No problem.
I'd love to start with a little bit about your background. You grew up in Hackney London.
Yeah.
What was early life like for little Jay?
Early life was really, really, really interesting. I grew up with my mum, and she had me when she was 17/18. She got kicked out of her family house and then had to move into a council house in Hackney. And it was an interesting time because we didn't have much money. I remember once I got the notion of asking, it's a very early memory, I had the notion of asking my mum for a sweet biscuit. I saw one down the market, and she went to the cupboard and she got a cracker and she sprinkled some sugar on it and said, there's your sweet biscuit. And that's how kind of poor we was. It was really, and I'm not saying we was poor in the sense that I want people to feel sorry for me. It was a really joyful time. I remember we used to go to the whole estate, used to club some money together, get a van, or I think it was a coach. We used to go in, everybody used to bring the packed lunch, or someone would bring coleslaw, someone would bring chicken, another one would bring some bread, and then we'll go to the beach, and no one had swimming costumes. We would all just swim in our Y fronts, and it was just like, that's the way it was. So growing up in Hackney was really poor and really beautiful. I think it made me the type of person that I am today. So everything that's happened to me, I'm really grateful that it's happened.
And you can look back at and feel that you learned some stuff that you've brought into life now?
I look back and see I've learned so much that some of the stuff that I've learned, I didn't even know I've learned. Because once I'm coming into, some people call me kind of like a social chameleon. And it's because I'm able to go into an environment and speak to people who I wouldn't normally communicate with because I'm from a certain part of Hackney. And Yeah, I just remembered something that we did. Me and my friend, well, two of my friends, when we were 16, we went to a place called Hyper Hyper. There was a...
Oh, yeah, I know Hyper Hyper.
High Street, Kensington.
I bought my first, you know, like, you know, sixth form, you get, you know, the balls and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I bought my dress there in Hyper Hyper,
yeah.
You know, with all the cubicles and all the small
yeah,
businesses.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I would, and you just like have a little curtain that you pull around and
that's
you
right.
try on these things. I talk about Hyper Hyper all the time. I loved it.
It was, but imagine this. You got a guy from Hackney, well, there's three guys from Hackney, council estate, and we had this idea of doing a fashion show. Obviously, in a fashion show, you need fashion. Where are you going to go? I go to Hyper Hyper. I buy clothes from there. Let's go and ask them. So we went to Hyper Hyper, went to loads of different stalls in there, and the funny thing was is that they gave us clothes. Three geezers from Hackney, they gave us clothes. We didn't have any money. We had an idea of what we was going to do, and... they gave us all this clobber and we said, all right, we're going to pick it up off of you on a Saturday and we'll bring it back on the Monday. And they was like, cool. I don't know. Now I look back at it, I'm like, you guys were really true. How did we persuade these people to do that? Now I look back, it's like, no way could you get someone to give you all of those designer clothes.
For free.
And you're going to bring them back in the next few days. So we had a certain quality about
you
us that was quite cool.
I'm sitting opposite you. I'm understanding that quality you might have had as a young Jay.
Yeah.
But was it right that life was quite frugal growing up? Do you think this is where your passion for upcycling came from?
The passion came from the passion had to have come from there because basically when you're poor, you don't have the opportunity of going to buy brand new.
Yeah.
So you make do with what you've got. So you would get a lot of hand-me-downs. I didn't have an older brother, so I would get hand-me-downs from uncles. That wasn't my uncle. They were family members who would look after me. So anything that we got or I got was secondhand. Secondhand to me was new back in the day. And... making stuff was quite cool as well because you would find stuff on the roadside. It could be an old bike frame and then you have to put stuff together to make yourself a bike. You would create, I remember a friend of mine wanted to become a DJ and he is a DJ now, DJ Spoonie. We had milk crates as his blocks to put his decks on. So that was his kind of table that we made and we would find those on the side because they were a bit broken and the milkman couldn't use them. So upcycling is the new term, but I think that in my day it was just being poor is what you did. But before then, it was the make do and mend culture.
Yes.
So I think my mum took it from there, and the whole of the poor community. We all lived the same way. It was just normal.
It was just the way you did things.
Yeah.
And when you were at school and.
Yes.
Were you drawn to creative subjects? I mean, this was your personal life. You were making DJ stands and things like that. So were you academic or was...
God blimey. Me, academic? Nah, not at all. One teacher said to me, I'm like two bits of wood, as thick as two thick planks is what I was. At the time...
How encouraging.
Very encouraging my school life was, I must admit. It was very...
God.
Yeah, they wanted me to be this shining student and it just didn't happen. I found out later on in life, I found out when I was 29 that I'm heavily dyslexic. And I found out at 29 that I have the reading ability of 11-year-old. So what the people that done the test on me said was that all of my academic learning had stopped when I went to secondary school. So you didn't take on board anything at secondary school. So secondary school was just about survival, really. And I was the first wave of black kids that went to that school. And the racism I received there was quite a lot. I'd done a lot of fighting, I would say, at the first and second year of secondary school because I didn't know. I had not experienced any form of racism being brought up in Hackney. We were just all poor. You had white, Asian, black, white. Everybody was all in the same mix. But when I went to Highbury and Islington, I recognised that I was a different race. So school... education or academic, no. Racism, definitely. That was on the agenda every day from, I think, year one.
You left school at 16 without any GCSEs or qualifications because, as you discovered, as you said, that you struggled with dyslexia.
Yes.
Do you think it still affects you now, dyslexia?
Yeah, definitely. I do have a problem with reading. My emails... when you send me emails, it's not going to happen. I'm not reading them. I always say to people, if you want me to get in contact with you, best thing to do, send an email and put a mobile number underneath there, because I always ring people up.
Yeah.
And some people get shocked out, like, oh, it's Jay. And I'm like, yeah, you've left the number. I'm going to ring you. But no, you're ringing me. Like, of course I'm going to ring you because I can't read your email. I want to hear what you're saying. So luckily I've got a project manager now, Hannah, who answers a lot of emails for me. Bless her cotton socks.
Yeah.
When she first came on board, she said, how many emails you got? I said, I think I've only got about 20. I had 2,500 that I hadn't read. That were just
in
there.
Your unread, that number. Well, is it? I suffer from dyslexia too, and I didn't realise I had it until later life. But I just think it shows you that you can survive, and you build these skills, don't you? And you thrive in other ways. And actually now when I talk to children, I definitely call it a superpower, because, you know, it makes you gravitate towards possibly creativity, creative thinking, innovation. And so many entrepreneurs, you've got to think, you know, Steve Jobs, Richard Branson, Joe Malone, all had dyslexia. And, you know, gives perhaps a business advantage, perhaps a way of thinking that, you know, you've had to work that muscle and other people haven't. So you're in very good company. You know, we're in good company here,
Jay.
Yeah,
we are.
So what was the next stage of the journey like? And what did you do after leaving school? So you were 16.
Right. 16, it was a case of doing really loads of menial jobs. It was just job after job after job. Really couldn't hold down a job. The things that I did enjoy doing was like the fashion show we did when I was 16, and just creating party nights along with my friends. So these were nights that you would put on and people would come and pay and all that kind of stuff. I did love fashion. I kind of got a bug for it because I was a guy born in Hackney, and then there was a certain way that you would communicate, and you would not communicate. There was a certain group of people that you would hang around with if you were from a certain part of Hackney. And by going to Hyper, or the hypermarket, I used to call it, you then ended up going to places like the Wag Club. You ended up going to Busby's, and these kind of places allowed me to see a different world. And it was really interesting to just bounce between the two. So one of the things that I did a lot of was basically I sold a lot of clothes. So I had a couple of market stalls and was selling stuff from place to place. So I was selling clothes. I had a shop at the Angel, and then also I had a shop in Camden Market, and we were selling secondhand clothes and stuff like that. So I was quite big on the secondhand scene. So selling dresses and also Levi's 501s is what I kind of got into, because of the areas that I was going to, and I saw there were people wearing these products, so I would be able to sell them that. And then when I was going to, back to Hackney, I would sell Hackney a particular type of clothing. So I remember once we organised this party, and I had sold, I must have sold about 50 of these Rain Max to people. Basically, they all, well, not all of them, there was about 30 people wearing the Rain Max all coming into this party, and it was just the weirdest scene you could ever think. And it was like, wow, that's quite freaky.
Freaky, yeah.
So I realised I could sell, basically.
And you decided, though, to return to your studies, going to university.
At 29.
At Buckinghamshire, where you studied criminology and psychology, and you received a 2-1.
Yes.
Is this right?
Yes.
So you left school with no qualifications.
None whatsoever.
But you went then to study something that actually I could imagine is, you know, pretty hard going.
A little bit more than hard going. You got to remember, I was still dyslexic.
Yeah.
And
what made you decide to do this?
I tell you what it was. It's like I love doing things that challenge me. I don't know why. It's just I love to push myself, and I love to push myself to do things that I've never ever done before and that I'm really scared of. So I know I wanted to have some form of education because I had none. I got to the age of 29. And you go through that kind of change at 29. 27 to 30 is a very strange time. Yeah. You're kind of weighing up, like, okay, I haven't made it. I haven't done this. What am I doing with my life? And so on and so forth. So 29, decided to go university. And I called a university up and I said to them, I'd like to study there. And they said, well, what do you want to study? And I said, I don't know. What subjects have you got? And they said, well, what are you interested in? I said, well, I like fashion. And I grew up in a poor area, so I know a bit about crime. I've seen people do crime a lot. And they said, well, you can do textile design or you can do criminology. And I said, criminology, what's that? And they said, well, it's the study of crime, why people do crime. So, wow, that sounds quite cool. So I chose that and they asked me to write a letter. I had a teacher that helped me to write a letter why I wanted to go to university. Then they gave me an unconditional offer. When I got into uni, it was very, very interesting because I didn't understand what the concept was. I thought you go there and you challenge everything. I thought that's what it was all about. And I was quite wrong. Yeah, I was quite wrong. But I learnt quite quickly the subjects I liked. I did like criminology. And in the first year, I learnt with a teacher called Trevor Hussey, who taught me philosophy. Basically, the study of argument, of how you argue your case. And philosophy was the best part, I would say. Criminology was more like professors studying poor people, saying that people that pick their nose, for instance, they're going to be more criminal than anybody else. And it's like, really? There's a little five-year-old who's picking his nose. That means he's going to be a criminal. You can't judge people in that way. So I had a lot of challenging
conversations there
around criminology. But philosophy, I love the whole point of the man that knows the most is the person that knows nothing. If you could turn around and say, I know nothing, then that's it. You know everything. That's the bottom line of philosophy in my eyes. Even down to having an argument of a chair. A chair is not a chair. It's made off of components, as in legs, a seat and a back and so on and so forth. So it's not a true chair. A true form of a chair is nobody knows because we haven't created it. Oh. It's the same like, and philosophy is very deep in that way. So
I wouldn't want to have that conversation after a bottle of wine. I mean,
we used to have loads of conversations like that. It was very, I must admit, it allowed me to understand my dyslexic thinking and the way that I operate. So I come up with things differently sometimes, and it just makes perfect sense.
And it was, whilst you were studying, you started a charity called Out of the Dark, which was a social enterprise that recycled, restored and revamped salvaged furniture as a means to train or educate, employ young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, helping, probably looking at your younger self, helping people, help them to develop their self-esteem and their confidence. Tell me about the story behind setting up this charity. And did you have success through it? Did you see success coming out of it?
Too much success. The thing I would say is that I started another charity before Out of the Dark, which was called Street Dreams. And that charity was basically working on the streets with disadvantaged young people. So we'd be employed by police, social services, you kind of name it. Everybody that wanted to reach hard to reach young people would employ myself to go and communicate with those young people because I am really good at doing that. But what I found is that the charity was a small charity and the funding started drying up. So I had a number of young people I was working with and that would work for me because my philosophy in doing the charity work was to work myself out of a job. So anybody I came into contact with, I would train them up and then basically they would then be able to take over doing what I was doing. Yeah. So they become the new leaders because I won't be cool and trendy anymore. They will be. So I still wanted to continue working with those young people. We had a number of young people that were youth leaders by now. So I needed to find another avenue to continue working with them and make our own revenue. And we came up with an idea of starting Out of the Dark, which was to train young people. And I think I never really believed the idea would take off. I didn't think that people were going to buy secondhand furniture. But then when we were in, I think it's the, I can't remember the magazine, I think it was the Architectural, but I can see it, but I can't remember the name of it. And we were in that magazine and someone had bought a piece of furniture that we had in there from Germany and we had to send it over. And I was wrapping this furniture up with a young person and it was just like, wow, this is a bit surreal. Someone has bought something they haven't touched, they haven't seen. They've seen it in a magazine and they've just bought it. They bought it because they liked the style. They didn't hear the story. They know nothing about it. They've just seen this piece.
It was actually because of what they had created.
Yeah, and that was it. And it was kind of surreal. But the successes we had, I think, in Out of the Dark was more to do around the young people, just showing them that there is a different way. Because the design world, historically, it's kind of middle class, upper class, I would say, is what it is. It doesn't represent the worker bees. Now, the worker bees are normally the guys on the shop floor doing it. And by bringing those young people into that world, it kind of made me look at how the industry are looking at these young people. And it was really weird. it's been really interesting just seeing this journey of designer myself.
And the kids that you helped out.
Yes.
Did you see that sort of sliding doors moment? You know, that because of what they were doing with you, they actually took another path, or that they were inspired enough by creating that. I'm wondering if those experiences changed people's lives.
I think that in an ideal world, anybody who works in the youth kind of industry and working with young people, you don't necessarily have those inspiring times, or someone has that light bulb moment where it's like, yep, bam, just switched on. Some of the simplest successes is that a young person's come in to your workshop every day. A young person is not smoking as much drugs. A young person is not committing any crime in that particular era. Those are the successes that don't necessarily get people singing and dancing. But for me, those really mean a lot. There was a young girl who hadn't smiled for, I think her mother told me, about three to four years. She hadn't smiled. She just, school, everything. She was kind of depressed and no professional could help her. And her mum was signposted to come along to Out of the Dark. And her mum came in on the sixth week and her mum was crying. And I was like, oh, is everything all right? And the young lady went downstairs to start on the work that she's doing. And I said to her, you okay? And then her mum explained to me that she smiled, and she actually explained at home what she was doing at Out of the Dark. And it's like, she said, you've done what people couldn't done in like years. You've got her to have a kind of purpose, and you haven't focused on any illness or whatever she's got. You've just taken her for face value and you've just worked with her straight away. And that's, to me, those are the kind of successes that most people wouldn't sing and dance
really
about.
You're really right to say this.
Yeah, but it's
you're
like
really
a smile.
You're really right, you know, me asking, you know, life-changing and sort of expecting maybe a story of someone and then they've gone on to do whatever. And you're really right to just hone it down onto the fact that having a great day,
yeah,
as you said, not doing something disruptive to your life,
yeah,
is actually winning in that moment in, yeah, time. And I think we forget that.
We're proud to partner with NatWest. They support small businesses in so many ways. Just one of these ways is through Backer Business. This programme will match fund up to £1 million a year, creating hundreds of successful applicants when they crowdfund through Backer Business. Listen to the end of this podcast to find out more. With a continued commitment to small businesses, NatWest, in a world first, give away the rest of this ad break space to small businesses and independents. They truly believe in the power of small and want to give you the opportunity to showcase your business to hundreds and thousands of listeners. So without further ado, let me hand over to this week's NatWest Independent Ad Break winner.
Hi, I'm Rachel, the founder of Rachel Shilston Inspiring Creativity, a creative business specialising in mosaic. As a trained art teacher, I discovered mosaic making about 10 years ago and was instantly hooked. I began offering it in my studio, and soon mosaic became my most popular class to teach. In a busy world where we are often glued to our phones or laptops, I could see mosaic making was really helping my class participants to unwind, have some creative downtime, and invest in themselves. I wanted to inspire more people using this absorbing craft, so I developed my own range of unique and fun mosaic kits. So no matter where you live in the world, your creativity can be inspired. Find out more about my classes and unique mosaic kits on my website at rachelshilston.co.uk or find me on social media. Thank you for listening.
If you'd like to take NatWest up on their generosity and be listened to by thousands of people, take that leap of faith and send in your small business advert to independentadbreaks@holly.co. We're looking for the wonderful stories that only small businesses have, and have created more information on exactly what we're looking for on our website, holly.co.
I hope you don't mind me touching on this, but you've gone through also some tough times in your life. Mm. You went through a dark period where your marriage broke up and you ended homeless, is this right, living
That's correct.
In a car. Could you tell us about, you know, you were giving out a lot at that point in time, giving out, and yet you yourself, you know, you were going through something that was extraordinary as well.
Yeah, I think the thing that happens when you are a giver and you are a pillar to most people in the community, when you fall down and you need help, it's very hard to ask the people that you have helped to help you. Not because of it's a pride thing, but it kind of creates that uncertainty in some people's lives that it's like, whoa, hold on a minute, Jay needs help. Well, if Jay needs help, what does that mean for me? Who's going to help me? Mm-hmm. How am I going to focus and what have you? So I think the thing for me when my marriage broke down and the business broke down, everything just collapsed. It was a case of running. That's what I needed to do, just run away from it all. And I remember speaking to one young person and I said to her that I'm going to go missing for a few days and people might get worried, but I'm going to be okay. I just need to get away because it's quite a lot. There was a lot of stuff I was dealing with at the time of the relationship breaking down and also the business breaking down because there was a lot of responsibilities that we had at the time. And getting in the car, I didn't actually know where I was going to go. And it was a case of just driving and driving. I did end up sleeping in the car for a few days. And then I had a bit of change. I don't know why I stayed in the car because I had money, but I ended up staying in a hotel one night, and then I got visited by, God blimey, it was two police officers, a psychiatric nurse, and a community doctor, I believe, that had to assess me to make sure that I was not a danger to myself because I went missing. And as I went missing, I needed time for myself to gather my thoughts, but also I didn't know what I was going to do. I could have drove off a cliff as far as I was concerned. My brain was absolutely, completely finished. There was nothing left in me. I didn't know whether I was going to turn right or turn left. It was just like...
Because of the shock of it all?
I tell you what it was. I had no one in my eyes, I believe. I had no one to turn to. I'd been brought up in an environment where you are a macho man. You are someone who is strong and you're independent and you're never going to show your weakness. There wasn't a possibility how I was growing up to show your vulnerability. Your vulnerability in my area would have been taken advantage of, plain and simple. And as it would have been taken advantage of, I got to the ripe old age of about 40-something and I had not shown anybody my vulnerability. So not showing anybody my vulnerability.
Long time.
Yeah, not showing them the vulnerability and then coming out of that, I didn't know where to go. And that's basically, it wasn't necessarily the shock. I think it was because I had no one to speak to, no one at all. There was no father figure. There was no male role model. All the male role models were a little bit naughty in my area. So you couldn't really speak to them about this sort of stuff.
But then you had a guardian angel who helped you back on track. We often speak on this podcast, actually, about looking for guardian angels who are there in your life and not being afraid to ask for help. So many people want to help and kindness actually is really out there. So you had the opportunity to start your own business restoring furniture again in a beautiful workshop in Wolverhampton.
Yeah.
This must have felt like an incredible new start for you. Tell me about that.
I think the start in Wolverhampton was really, really nice. And I didn't know how nice it was. And to mention about guardian angels, I think we all have guardian angels. Sometimes we don't recognize who they are. And I think everybody that I've come into contact with in my life has been my guardian angel. I just didn't realize it. I wasn't open enough to understand
it. So you felt like they were already all around you, but actually then they showed themselves.
I allowed to see when you allowed it.
When
I
you,
opened my eyes.
Yeah.
So basically,
that makes me, that's lovely.
I think everybody I've grown up with, even the people that were naughty, they've shown me, and I say this to a number of young people that I work with sometimes, it's like the people who are in your era who are the alcoholics, the people who are the junkies and what have you, they are your teachers. They're teaching you what not to do. But guardian angel and starting new in Wolverhampton, to tell you the truth, I didn't really have a plan. It's just that my guardian angel, or my new adopted brother is what I like to call him, said to me, you can go into this building and do your arty-farty stuff. I know you need to be creative. You need to... and I remember him saying to me, you need to splash paint around. And I said, I don't actually splash it around. I like to keep it on the brush or in the tin. I don't like to be messy. And he's like, well, you know what I mean. Just go in there and do what you want. And the guy that gave me this new kind of arty-farty start was Gerald Bailey. He adopted me into his family. That was... It was like the rebirth of me. And yeah, he allowed me to do a few things. He allowed me to cry. He made it okay. There was no stigma attached to actually showing emotion. Whereas, as I said, growing up, you show that vulnerability, you are a victim. End of story. And to show your vulnerability and not become a victim was kind of like, was that a lie I was told for the last 40 years? It must have been a lie, because I'm showing my vulnerability to this guy and he's not laughing, he's not joking, he's not told anybody, he's not having a laugh about it at my expense. Wow, how wrong was I? Is what I thought.
Oh, gosh.
There's been a few things. I tell you what, I feel so, so blessed. It is just unbelievable. There's sometimes that I look back. I don't really get much chance to look back at what's going on in my life. But when I do, and it's just happened just now, you get the fur come up on the back of your neck, yeah. And you get this kind of lump in your throat, and your eyes start to do this watering up. And you think to yourself, what's happening to me? Oh, I'm getting an emotion is what it is. It's okay.
That's it.
That the times that I remember that is, yeah.
Beautiful.
Exactly. It is beautiful.
And how old were you when all of this was happening?
So the time that I fell down was when I was 46. And yeah, this happened when I was 46. Sorry. Yeah. I'm just trying to remember.
Yeah. It just goes to show you that we can have these incredible second chances at any age, at any time in our lives. We're often told that opportunities and these turnarounds happen when we're young, but it can happen at any point. And starting to live out our passions, doing what we love, following a path of happiness, we can do this at any age. It is never too late. Second chances, third chances, fourth chances. We all deserve it.
Yes.
Going through that time, what advice would you have for anyone listening and struggling right now who might be feeling lost in their lives?
I think the biggest thing that has helped me, the thing that helped me the most is basically talking and opening to people. That's it. Once people are aware of what you're going through, they do help. They do support. If you speak to the right people, now don't get me wrong, there are some people who are not going to help you. Plain and simple. And your stomach normally tells you, don't speak to so-and-so. They're not going to help you. So I would strongly recommend to people, you do need to speak to people. Because where I was brought up, you didn't speak about those emotional stuff. You didn't speak about how you was feeling. It just didn't happen. And by speaking to someone, it made it so normal that that person would just help. And it was like, I thought they would never help. But yeah, they helped. And here I am 4 years later, and I owe Gerald Bailey, I owe him a lot. He sees things differently in the way that I function, because he's a very business-orientated businessman. It's like, it's facts and numbers. There's no feely, there's no touchy stuff to it. But I've come and put the kind of fluffy element to it. It's like
the arty-farty part.
There you go. So he's made it. He's got a bit of feeling in him
he's
now.
He's got a bit of feeling in yeah. him now. And then miraculously, you had this huge break in life. A TV company approached you for a new program called Money for Nothing.
That's correct.
After seeing a video of you and your charity, and they wanted you as a presenter for a pilot show. Right. What was that moment like? Because it must have felt like everything was slightly coming together for you.
I think Money for Nothing, it kind of happened twofolded. So Money for Nothing filmed a pilot with me at Out of the Dark. So this was before the charity had folded. And then after the charity had folded and I was in Wolverhampton doing my arty-farty stuff in that warehouse, they came along again and said, we're ready to film this show. Do you want to be part of it? So they filmed me for two seasons being an artisan, making things, and then in the third season or the third series, they wanted me to be a presenter. And to tell them the truth, I'm doing two shows on the BBC and it hasn't hit home yet in the sense of my reason for being in TV is to influence people who I'm never going to meet. So it's to show people from my neck of the woods, that's the poor side of town, that you can do something completely different. Yeah. You don't have to follow the narrative that is you either be a sports person, a musician, or you end up doing crime. You can do something completely different. You can be in the design world. So it's only when I get to the position that I'm trying to get to influence more people, will it actually hit home? Because it doesn't really sink in. I'm just having unbelievable fun. I'm having a time of my life just mucking about. I get a chance with Money for Nothing to turn around things that people are throwing away. It's like, really? You're going to throw that away? I can do this with it. And you end up doing something amazing with it. Then the repair shop, you've got... I'm really blessed. It's crazy.
It is. It's they're perfect for you. It's talking about the repair shop. It's a brilliant concept to help other people think about restoring, updating what they have. As you said, what they might throw away. And obviously, you've got great on-screen charisma. I mean, sitting here. You know, yeah, you've got it. And these inspiring skills in updating outdated, unloved furniture. You look great. Your aprons. They're doing it.
Very kind.
And it was only a matter of time, really, when you now look back, that you were going to be spotted, you know, because it's, and I know you maybe can't see that, but actually you're made for it. And anyone that hasn't seen it, you must see it, the repair shop. It's absolutely addictive. Tell us a story of some of the people that you've met through that program, because it's very emotional.
Yes. I think the repair shop is very, as you say, it's very emotional, but it's very of the time. I think when I'm analysing TV now, there's been a lot of shows since the rise of Big Brother. So, for instance, with Nasty Nick was probably the first
Nick.
I'm going back.
Yeah, the last one I watched. Yeah. But it was a good one, right?
It's a good one. And I think since then there has been this kind of onslaught of TV shows that kind of are being horrible to people.
Mm-hmm.
They're either taking the mickey, like You're the Weakest Link and all those kind of shows where you look at people and you laugh at their naivety to believe in that they are great. So you've had some of those talent shows that then laugh at the people that are coming on who might not have much talent. But I think with the likes of the repair shop, it's struck a nerve with the nation and internationally, I should say, that it's about being nice and about being kind to people. And that's something I think we need to get back to.
Because
if we don't do that, the problem is, one, we're destroying the planet at an alarming rate, so it's proven that we don't give a damn about the planet. And then two, if we continue making the shows that art imitating life or life imitating art, you can't keep acting this way to people. I think it's quite wrong. So the likes of the repair shop has struck a nerve to show people it's okay to be nice. And it's okay to be going back to the old days where you repair something and you fix it. Not for any money, not for any kind of financial gain for your business or to make a profit and all that kind of stuff, which a lot of shows are focused on. It's all about, there you go. Your memory is priceless. As your memory is priceless, we're going to give you this item.
And that's the thing, you know, because you pick from teddy bears to radios, old rocking horses, all treasured family heirlooms that are in dire need of repairing. And then it's the story that goes with them, the expertise of the craftspeople, and they reveal that moment to the families that then see this restored object. And just so many tears. And it is TV gold. And I think about business as well. And I think about The Apprentice and I think about Dragon's Den and, again, tearing people down. And in this day and age where we are desperately dealing with mental health issues, technology is just, you know, sucking us up. And TV, if it wants to stay present, you know, it needs to start connecting.
Yeah.
But it is about this emotions. Why do we watch the Antiques Roadshow still? Yeah. You know, it's connecting to us as humans. And it's an interesting thing. And I think that you've just hit it. It's a show based in kindness.
Yeah. And I think, well, you would know about kindness because you basically set up a business that is supporting people who might not get a look in elsewhere. They might not, as your business says, not on the high street. They won't get a look in on the high street. So you've created something that is offering them a platform, which is being kind. There is a kind of movement, I believe, that has been started not only by the repair shop, but a load of other people along the way, yourself included, that has given people a chance to display what they're good at. And that's what it basically is. So you've done it with Not on the High Street, and we're doing it with the repair shop.
Yeah.
We've got guys and girls that are on there that are really good at what they do. They are the best in the world.
I mean, they are unbelievable.
Yeah, it's crazy. I walk around in the repair shop and I am in awe of these guys. And I'm not only talking in front of the camera, because the guys who fix stuff, Will, Kirsten, Steve, Susie, Lucia, all those guys are brilliant. There's guys at the behind the camera that I've seen grow and do things that it's just like, wow.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful show to be part of, and it's a beautiful family to be part of as well, because it is a family down there. Really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really like a family. That we take the mickey out of each other. You have some dysfunctional family members. We've got Uncle Pete. He fixed the musical stuff like trumpets and all that. And one time, sorry to digress a bit, but let me tell you about Pete. Uncle Pete, we call him. He came into the workshop, and we're going to do an arrival. Someone's coming in to bring an item in. So he turns up and he's got this kind of beige jumper on. And I'm like, all right, Pete, you're going to get changed. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, you're going to get changed and to put something nice on. He said, I've got my jumper on. I said, like, I can see you've had egg, you've had some beans, got some brown sauce on there. And I think that might be tomato ketchup. Is that right? He said, yeah, that's from last week. That is that tomato ketchup. And I said, do you know there's a few million people that watch this show? And he's like, yeah. And I'm, you're not going to change your jumper. This is my work jumper. And I'm like, you know what, Pete? No problem. Your Uncle Pete, you do what you want to do. You're going to be on, no problem. And we just filmed with this jumper. But he is...
I love that.
Uncle Pete is very special. Yeah.
Well, you've got to have an army of super fans. Stephen Fry said it's the best programme on British television, calling it a fine antidote to the mad digital world.
Yeah.
I mean, can you get better than that? You know, think back to your whole life, and you have Stephen Fry basically saying you're an antidote to basically the mayhem we're all experiencing.
I listen, when Stephen Fry said that, it was a true honour. We've got Richard Osman, we've got Graham Norton, Greg James. He says stuff about us. It's unbelievable, unbelievable. But the one thing that does really shock me out is when we get an item in and you see... And see, the fur's just come up on the back of my neck again because I'm just remembering one. Basically, what happens is you repair an item for someone, and let's say this person's about 50, 60 years old. It's almost as if you see this person shrink to being that five-year-old again.
Mm.
When you reveal this item to them, it is one of the most humbling and beautiful experiences you can ever be part of, because it's almost as if you're into someone else's world. The cameras are not there. It's really, really weird. So
you're transported
completely into their world, and it's really, really beautiful. And I know what Stephen Fry and all the guys are saying, but when you're there and you're filming it and you're in the moment, it's like someone's taking your breath away, because you become speechless, and it is really, really special. And those moments, we've had so many of them in the barn. Yeah, it does blow me away.
We've teamed up with our friends at Three, and all year we'll be working together to make dreams come true. Share your dreams on social using hashtag HollyandCoDreamer, and who knows what will come true. With a Three Means business plan, I love that you can get up to £500 worth of benefits from their partners to help give your business a lift in those early days. Now over to a short story about those that dreamed big and flew. Sir Timothy John Berners-Lee is an English engineer and computer scientist, and is best known as the inventor of the World Wide Web. It is without a doubt that his truly visionary dreams and innovative work has transformed almost every aspect of our lives.
Somewhat a maverick, Tim Berners-Lee never directly profited off his invention and has spent most of his life trying to guard it. From the very beginning, he understood how the epic power of the web would radically transform governments, businesses, societies, and that in the wrong hands, it could be disastrous. Connecting people globally was all a product of his magical mind, one that was fueled in his university bedroom by a computer he was given to tinker with. He saw that there was an issue for people to connect the world over and wanted to solve it. But believe it or not, Tim's initial proposal was not immediately accepted. Likened to another dreamer and activist, Tim has been described as the Martin Luther King of our new digital world, making the decision to release the web as an open and democratic platform for all. Tim once said that the breathtaking growth of the web has been a lesson for all dreamers, that you can have a dream and it can come true.
Don't forget to share your own business dream using hashtag Holly & Co Dreamer. To discover more about business plans, search 3 Means Business.
Do you think the show and what you believe in is encouraging this make and mend philosophy more? Do you feel that, you know, what's your take on what's happening around the world at the moment? And, you know, that this is your little bit towards starting to change people's minds? You know, okay, I'm not going to throw that away. Actually, I'm going to do something with this.
Yeah. I think that movement has already been going on.
Yeah.
And I think the beauty with a show like The Repair Shop is actually captured at the right time that everybody is thinking of these things. I think one of the biggest things that The Repair Shop has done, and a few other people have done it, and yourself included, is we've created a community. So we've created a community of people that are like-minded, that want to repair something. And then you create a community of people. So we get a lot of older people watching the show with their grandchildren. So they'll pick the grandchildren up from school because mum or dad's working and all that kind of stuff. So they'll do that duty. And it's quite surreal when you get half term happening and you're filming down at the repair shop and you get mum, dad and grandparents. And the grandparents know me, the children know me, and the mum and the dad are like, who is this guy? Like, oh, it's Jay. And the little kids and the granddad, let's take a picture there. And you can see the mum and dad like holding the camera like, okay, I'm going to take a picture of this guy, but I don't know who he is and why are you all gaga over this guy? And then when they go and watch the show, they come back in a few weeks' time and actually say, oh, we really love it, blah, blah, blah. It's creating communities, which I think we've kind of lost. We've created communities of social media where we're very... we point the finger, we press the like button, we comment, and we comment without thinking about how we might be hurting someone or saying something about that person's life that we know nothing of because we've only got 140 characters that explains what they're trying to say that might have taken them years to create. So I think with shows like The Repair Shop, community is what it's all about, and it's about being nice to people. So we need to bring that back.
It's just, and learning these new skills that have been gradually dying out, you know, upholstery, sewing, woodworking, all these artisan crafts that most people could do 50 years ago. Do you think we'll see a resurgence in these skills?
If I have something to do with it, yes. I work closely with a charity called the Heritage Craft Association, and they have a list called the Red List, which talks about the endangered crafts in England. So these are crafts that someone is doing and they don't have an apprentice. So when they pass away, that's the last person that's going to be doing that craft is gone. So we lost the last living guy making a cricket ball in the traditional way. I think he passed away in 2019 October, so we can't make those anymore in that particular way. So
it's the endangered species of craft it's going to go.
Yeah, it's basically there are some crafts on that list which are critical.
Yeah,
and then there's some that are non-critical, and there's some that are endangered. So there's some that are extinct; they don't exist anymore. Like we don't make a cricket ball in a traditional way in England anymore. That guy's passed. He didn't have an apprentice. It's over. So they
couldn't
made somewhere.
People apply to be the apprentice?
They could apply, but sometimes The person who is doing this endangered craft might not be set up to take an apprentice. They might not have the finances to bring in an apprentice and pay for them, because it's all well and good, this renaissance of crafts, but some of the crafts, they're not, business terms, they're not viable to continue as a business. Because it's done in an old-fashioned way, and not many people are going to do that. So when we look at, let's say, for instance, upholstery. I'm not saying upholstery is a dying craft, but not a lot of people will pay the money to do traditional upholstery, which is sometimes double, if not triple, the amount of modern. Modern is foam, which is quite simply cover the foam and stuff like that, but foam is not good for our environment. Traditional, which is springs and horsehair, or koi fibre, which is just like like coconut fibre, which is very good for the environment. Traditional is very, very eco-friendly, but not many people will pay for that. So it's just looking at what is viable. The thing that I'm trying to do with my little outside world is influence the things that come into the repair shop, so we create a renaissance of these crafts being, oh, I remember someone who used to make a wheel in that way. And also at my outside of the repair shop, I want to start workshops called the Red List Workshops. So I will get the endangered crafts.
I love this.
Workshops. People up and down the country who are like the last person to do it, come to my workshop, teach people how to do what you're doing, and that might spark something else.
I love that.
Yeah, so like the domino effect is what I'm trying to create.
Oh, and you're doing this? No, you want to do this.
We're in talks to get those guys, because sometimes it's not always viable to bring down particular crafts to the workshop. It costs quite a lot of money to bring all those all the equipment.
Yeah,
but there's a few that we're gonna start with, so we should be doing it in the summer when I get a break from the repair shop and money for nothing.
Just incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, all night I could talk to you. And I know you've got an event on this evening. But lastly, I end all these interviews with the analogy that the journey in life and in business is often like being on an epic roller coaster. Your carriage you would have crafted by hand. God knows what materials you would have used. You would have carved your name in the side, I'm sure, and the doors would be opening beautifully. What would you say has been one of the biggest lows whilst you've been on your journey?
The biggest low has got to be believing that no one wanted to help you. That's the biggest low. And I felt that on about four occasions in my life. So I've had four lows where I believed that people didn't want to help me. They was not interested. And that was my own self telling me that. There was no one that said, I'm not going to help you. There was no one being horrible to me. It was just what I was led to believe.
And on the opposite scale of that, when you're riding high, you haven't got any hair on the top of your head, but if you did, it'd be with wind blowing through it.
Wind blowing through my hair. The high, I would say, of my career has to be when I was crying in Gerald Bailey's car, when I actually had that moment where it was like, it was okay to cry. It was okay to actually ask for help. And that was that. Even though it was a time where I was at my lowest point, it was the rebirth of me. It was almost like a snake shedding its skin, and you come out and you're feeling quite refreshed. You feel very vulnerable as a snake because you come out and you're like, oh, this is a new skin that I'm in. Like, how am I going to? And I didn't know how he was going to react to me. But ever since that moment, I just speak to people. It's beautiful. It's beautiful to talk. It's nice to cry. It's nice to have emotions. It's like, Jesus, why didn't I do this years ago? If I did this years ago, I would be a lot further in my career somewhere. I don't know where it would be.
Where you would be.
Yeah. It's quite weird that the high is a crying moment. Yeah.
And tell me who you think has inspired you, that you think you could personally recommend for me to interview for this podcast.
So one person that I kind of admire, I wasn't really a TV person. I don't really watch TV that much. And even now, I find it a bit like, when I watch myself on telly, it's not.
So do you watch yourself?
Oh, it's painful. It's unbelievably painful. I love the repair shop, but I don't like me in it. I don't want to see me. I'm like,
You know it's got to be done, but
it has to be done for work purposes, and then to say like, okay, don't say that word too much. You're doing this, you're doing it. Okay, walk around. And you really analyse yourself unbelievably. But I've watched TV from time to time, and there's a guy called Young Philly, and he does this program called Hot Property, BBC Three. Wow. When I saw him on telly and doing what he does, he's a presenter, but he's a presenter with so much energy, so much gusto for life. It's like, wow. I was in awe. I was envious of this guy's energy, his passion. It was just like, I think... Young Philly has reminded me of if I was brave enough to actually open up and be as courageous to talk about my emotions from the age of 11, 12 years old, I would be like him. And it's a beautiful thing to see your younger self on telly. Yeah. The younger self you never was.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow. Yeah. This guy, he is
you're almost
really
proud of him.
It's more than proud. It's almost as like, there was one point I was sitting down watching the telly with my partner, and I was saying in my mind, "Go on, Jay." And I was like, "Oh, what do you mean, go on? He's not Jay. He's Young Philly. This is who, but he had he's got an energy that's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. So him, I admire, really.
Wow, thank you. He sounds pretty epic. And you're pretty epic, actually.
Oh,
I hope you don't mind me outing your age, but you're 49, is that right?
Going to be 50 in a couple of days.
50 in a couple of days. Woo-hoo. And you are at the prime of your life, doing exactly what you love, doing exactly what you were born to do. Your energy is infectious.
Thank you.
And how you help others and through your passion and your skills, touching people's souls, and huge congratulations to you. And I hope to visit this magical workshop in West Sussex one day, and it would be wonderful to be shown around. But at this point in time in the podcast, I now hand over to you a letter to your younger self, but it won't be a letter, but it will be a talking to from yourself now to your younger self. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm gonna talk to my
younger
self.
You're gonna talk to your little Jay.
I'm gonna speak to my little Jay at 49 years old. It is the weirdest concept to ever think of. Because growing up, I didn't believe I would get to a ripe old age. I didn't think I would get to 50 years old. Growing up where I was growing up, it was a bit naughty in those areas, and not a lot of people made it. So when you asked for me to do this, it was a surreal experience. I'll try and do it. There we go.
Okay. Dear Jay.
Yeah. So, dear Jay, this is your 49-year-old self speaking to you, and there's a few things I want you to know, but one of the main things you do need to know, it is okay to be emotional. It is okay to allow people to come in and see that you're vulnerable, and those people that see you being vulnerable are not going to hurt you. They're not going to take you down a particular path that's going to lead you to a place that you don't want to end up. They're going to take care of you. They're going to look after you, and in turn, you would look after them. The other big thing I want you to know and understand is that you shouldn't be angry that your dad is not around. So by being angry that your dad's not around, you use that as an excuse not to go forward. You use it as an excuse to continue being angry at men that are offering you advice, men that could potentially take you up a path that is going to lead you to something really, really beautiful. The other thing I would love to say to you is enjoy everything you are doing, because everything you've done so far, even though you believe that you're in a particular area that is rough and it's horrible and you want to get out of it and you feel really depressed about that particular area, is going to make you one of the most rounded, beautiful, caring and understanding person that I will ever know. I am so proud of who you are and what you're about to become that I wish that I could go back and hug you and kiss you and tell you that everything's going to be okay. Because when you get to 50, you're going to be smiling and you're going to be speaking to a young lady called Holly, who does this thing called Not on the High Street. And wow, you're going to go on a really, and I mean really, emotional roller coaster. But enjoy every single moment of it, and keep smiling. Yeah, that's me.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm just so happy for you. I just, you know, yeah. my other half is going to turn 60 this year. Uh-huh. And I know men have, you know, lots of difficult journeys with emotions and things like that. Yeah. And what I'm just so happy for you is that your whole life is opening up now. And we're going to see you blossom, and you're 50 and you are, you know, you've got sunbeams coming out of you. Yeah. And I'm just incredibly happy for you. And I wish you everything. Yes. I think, yeah. I wish you everything.
No, you're a special lady. No, thank you.
Thank you.
You asked me to do this. And I don't know if anybody can hear this. They should be able to hear this because you've got a couple of people watching, listening to this.
Yes.
Holly's actually got a tear. And I think we're sharing a tear together. It's really, really beautiful. Sometimes in life what happens is you connect with people and you don't even need to say anything because you can just look into their soul. But this lady, Holly, is special. And she doesn't know that she's special. She's just doing all this stuff. But she's really, really special because I know a lot of people. And the people that I've spoken to before coming on here really want to say thank you for what you've done.
Because you have.
You have done a lot. You
have done a lot. You're going to have me flawed in a minute, Jay.
Forget you're flawed. You have to take on board what you have done for people who, as I said, were doing stuff in their kitchen, sometimes in the shed. And some people have partners that don't believe in them. But your business have believed in people and then given them a chance to get away from certain individuals. So thank you.
Well, it's my whole life to do this. So thank you so much for saying it. Thank you.
Before you go, here's a little more about Back Her Business. Last year, NatWest's CEO, Alison Rose, wrote the Rose Review and discovered that if women launched and scaled businesses at the same rate as men, it would represent an untapped £250 billion opportunity for the UK economy. Isn't that unbelievable? So they created Back Her Business, managed by Crowdfunder. This programme will match fund up to £1 million a year, creating hundreds of successful applicants when they crowdfund through Back Her Business. To find out more information, search NatWest Back Her Business.
And if you've enjoyed this conversation, if it has helped you along your own journey or inspired you, would you mind rating and reviewing this episode and podcast? Your support means the world, and it really does spread the word and will help inspire even more people to build a life they love.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown. You will find that all the things that I have said will come true when you are lying in